fifth case for argument this morning is Eckstein against McCautry. Mr. Hennick.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Robert Hennick, and I represent Joseph Eckstein in this appeal. The issue before the Court, fundamentally, is whether the Wisconsin Court of Appeals' rejection of Eckstein's ineffectiveness of counsel claim is contrary to or an unreasonable application of controlling Supreme Court precedent dealing with the ineffective assistance of counsel. It's not entirely that, because one of the issues on deficient performance, the Court of Appeals did not decide, and therefore that issue was de novo. But in any event, I would like to focus my attention today on the issue of resulting prejudice, given the time constraints. And the first point on that I would like to make is that the respondent did not respond to, did not contest, and therefore concedes, I believe, that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals standard, legal standard that they applied, is in fact contrary to that required by Strickland. Specifically, the Court of Appeals applied a reliability standard, or at one point even a sufficiency of the evidence standard, when, as we all know, Strickland requires prejudice to be assessed by determining whether counsel's alleged errors created a reasonable probability of a different result. Given that the issue of prejudice, I submit,
but the Wisconsin Court of Appeals refers many times to Strickland. It seems to know that it's asking the question whether this additional, I'm not sure whether you're referring to the additional cross-examination of Graham or the tapes, would not likely have led the court to reach a different conclusion. It's a trial to the court, right?
Right.
The underlying trials, and the court's the trier of fact. And beyond that, the Supreme Court has told us, that we're not supposed to sit around and really parse exactly whether the state courts are citing the right things, most recently in Mitchell against Esparza. But they say it all the time. You've got to look at the substance of what the state court did and ask the question whether that is consistent with Supreme Court precedent, here Strickland. And I have to say, it seems to me a reasonable court could say that the lawyer faced with even just the police tapes in this instance could rationally think that further cross-examination of Graham and going ahead and letting the tapes be used is about the only choice he has strategically. He's facing a very difficult trial with the police tapes, talking about loading somebody into a car and burying her in a cornfield, whether the word murder is used or not. I mean, it's a tough trial. Strategically, it seems to me the lawyer decides the best shot is to say, try to persuade the court as trier of fact that this is really all about planning drugs. And he tries and he fails. But I mean, that's a jury issue, right? That's not a habeas issue.
I totally agree it was an extremely difficult trial. It's also an extremely difficult habeas. I can totally agree with that. I believe that there are two separate issues that you were just discussing. If we address first the standard that the State Court of Appeals applied, it specifically said that to satisfy the prejudice prong, the defendant must show that counsel's errors were serious enough to render the resulting conviction unreliable. Now, that, I confess, is taken directly from Strickland. However, the State Court of Appeals did not go to what that means. And under Strickland, what that means is a reasonable probability of a different result. We have Williams v. Taylor.
Why should they have to? All they have to do is resolve the case.
Yes.
You don't have to write an exegesis on Strickland each time in order to come within the statute.
Of course not. You're absolutely correct. However, they do have to indicate somewhere in their opinion that they are applying the correct standard. The standard, the only standard that they refer to, the unreliability standard.
Actually, the case Judge Wood referred to, the Supreme Court said they don't even have to mention our precedents. They just have to avoid contradicting them.
Yep, I totally agree. And in this case, they contradicted it both by the statement of the standard, because they did not include the reasonable probability of a different result. And also, when you look at the last page...
The Ninth Circuit said that when granting a writ in one case, and they got summarily reversed 9-0. I mean, you're essentially asking us to track a line of reasoning that we know not a single justice agrees with.
Actually, I would disagree with that, given Williams v. Taylor, the Supreme Court...
You don't think they were reversed 9-0?
I have no doubt that that you are accurate on that. However, I would also point out that Williams v. Taylor, the Supreme Court held that a reliability standard, without taking into account the reasonable probability of a different result, is in fact contrary to the controlling standard in Strickland. Also, this court in Washington v. Smith, where the same Wisconsin Court of Appeals applied the same standard, this court reversed, granted habeas relief. I also note that if you look further down and actually look at the discussion that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals had on the prejudice issue, the discussion is not even of reliability. The discussion is what a court could find, and essentially is applying a sufficiency of the evidence standard, which is even more inappropriate. And that's in paragraph 25 of that decision. Thus, even without Eckstein's recording, there is enough evidence in the police recordings to corroborate Graham's testimony and allow a reasonable fact finder to determine that Eckstein did indeed wish to have his wife killed. Consequently, Eckstein suffered no prejudice. That's a sufficiency of the evidence standard that is not even a reliability standard, and it certainly is not a reasonable probability of a different result standard.
I read the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision, not the paragraph 21 part where he mentioned, where they mention unreliability, but the paragraph 25 part as holding that they don't think the result would be different. I mean, I can't see how they could have come to that bottom line. They say, even without Eckstein's recording, there's enough evidence in the police recordings to corroborate Graham's testimony and allow a reasonable fact finder to determine that Eckstein did indeed wish to have his wife killed. Consequently, Eckstein suffered no prejudice. What seems to me what they're saying is, we don't think the result would be different. They don't actually, in quotes, use that phrase, but what could they mean in that paragraph?
Well, I respectfully disagree. I believe that when they talk about there being enough evidence to convict, that what the court is doing is a sufficiency of the evidence standard, which the U.S. Supreme Court rejected in Kyles v. Whitley, dealing with the same reasonable probability of a different result.
Different test. Okay.
And that is how I read that particular paragraph. And I would also note that given Washington v. Smith, unfortunately, the other cases that I know of have not been cited, so I won't cite to them. But from my experience, during this period of time, it was consistently, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals consistently was applying a reliability standard rather than a reasonable probability of a different result standard.
Do you seriously think, I mean, standing here today, in light of the evidence that we all know could come in, that there is a reasonable probability of a different result?
Yes. And the reason that I believe that is that the issue at trial was essentially context. Do these words that were stated in the police tapes or Mr. Eckstein's tapes, whatever, are they related to a plan to kill Eckstein's wife, or are they related to the original plan to plant drugs on her, taking into account the possibility of self-defense?
I must say I don't understand that. I can understand a claim that people are talking in code when they talk about potatoes in lieu of cocaine or something like that. But I don't understand a claim that somebody, in order to talk about planting drugs on somebody, you use words of murder and burial as a code for planting drugs.
No.
That would be so weird.
That would be weird.
Unimaginable.
Yes, that certainly would be weird. And if
so
that was all
any possibility of the result being different.
And I totally agree that would be very weird if that were the only thing. However, if you look at the transcripts of the tape, we don't have the tapes because the respondent objected to my request to include those in the record. So we don't actually have the tapes. This court is left without the actual words that were said. But even if you look at the transcript, and we assume that the transcript is accurate, there is discussion in there about the planning drugs in the September 2nd, starts the planning drugs, and then it goes on from there. Mr. Eckstein testified that, yes, there was discussion about possible ways of dealing with someone if you're caught. He explained it as being self-defense. And I see my time is up, so.
Thank you, Mr. Hennick. Mr. O'Brien.
Good morning. May it please the court. The issue for this court is whether the Wisconsin courts acted unreasonably when they concluded that Mr. Eckstein failed to prove counsel performed both deficiently and prejudicially so with respect to the cross-examination of Crystal Gale regarding her mental health problems to establish that she lacked the ability to recall events.
Crystal Graham, actually. Crystal Gale's a singer.
Did I say... I thought that earlier, and I said, I better not... I'm sorry, Crystal Graham. And whether the Wisconsin courts acted unreasonably in concluding that Mr. Eckstein failed to prove prejudice with respect to the failure to file a suppression motion regarding Mr. Eckstein's own September 3 tape of the encounter. It is our position that the Wisconsin courts acted in full conformity with Strickland v. Washington. They did conclude that the result is reliable, but I think the only reasonable reading of that decision is that it so concluded because, as did the trial court, there is no reasonable probability of a different outcome here. If you take out Mr. Eckstein's September 3 tape, there really was no dispute at the trial or at the post-conviction hearing that police had their own tape, not only of the September 2 encounter, but of the September 3 encounter.
Why did you object to the tapes themselves being in the record?
They really don't add anything. We have the transcripts in the record.
Well, they add some question about how bad was the police transcription. Is it really a perfect substitute for Mr. Eckstein's somewhat weird own tapes?
The only inaccuracy cited, or the only alleged inaccuracy cited, appears at pages 47 and 48 of Mr. Eckstein's brief, which is this business about whether he said, load her in the garage or murder her in the garage. That's the only inaccuracy anyone's ever suggested occurred. No one at trial disputed the accuracy of the transcript. No one at the post-conviction stage, other than this one minor point, disputed the accuracy of the transcript.
The oven cleaner stuff is not.
That's the September 2nd.
That's
the September 2nd police tape.
Yeah.
So even the accuracy of the September 3 tape is corroborated by the accuracy of the September 2 tape. We would suggest that it is also corroborated by Crystal Graham's testimony at trial, where she discussed in great detail both of these conversations. And Mr. Eckstein took the stand at trial and was specifically questioned about these statements about murdering her in the garage. He was specifically examined about, the tapes reveal that you said and Crystal Graham testified that you discussed murdering her in the garage and loading her in the car and burying her in the cornfield. He did not respond by saying, that's not what I said, that's inaccurate. His response was something to the effect of, it's sort of nebulous, but it's basically, I was just going along with her crazy fantasies. I mean, that's in essence what he testified to. So, sure, could the tape, the tape has some relevance, certainly, but every item of evidence arguably has some relevance. The fact is there was no need for it here because we've already got the transcript, and there's only one disputed portion of the transcript in issue here, and we would suggest that really is not a major discrepancy because...
I still find it bizarre that you take it upon yourself to decide what we might think is useful. If we started listening to the tape and said, this is just what the transcript said, presumably we'd stop. I just don't see what was the extra harm of having those tapes in the box, that comes to this court.
Well, you get into logistical matters, too, when you're talking about trying to produce trial exhibits and exhibits that have long, years ago have been stored away in various locations. And, That's why the federal habeas rules require a showing of relevance. And I would agree that if we didn't have the transcripts that accurately portray what the tape said, then obviously it takes on far greater relevance. But the fact is, again, no one at the trial court or even at the post-conviction level argued that the transcript of the police September 3 tape is inaccurate, other than in this one point. So, if you were sitting here as an appellate court, yes, obviously that would be included as an exhibit, and you would likely listen to it. But on habeas review, did the Wisconsin courts act unreasonably in stating that in light of the transcript and in light of the tapes that were admitted, the September 2 tape and Mr. Eckstein's September 3 tape, and the testimony of all the witnesses, including Graham and Eckstein himself, and the testimony of the post-conviction attorneys who said that there really was no major, they weren't surprised by anything once they listened to the Eckstein's September 3 tape. They had already listened to the police tapes, and when they had the opportunity to listen to the September 3 tape, they said, well, there's really nothing new here. In fact, Eckstein's tape is even more complete. So, not more accurate, but more complete. So I just don't know that that really adds much, and certainly the court could overrule my objection and order that included. I mean, there's nothing to prevent that, and the district court could have done so as well, but the district court agreed that there really was no need in light of what all of the other items that are in the record, that there really is no need to also dig up this tape and produce it for the district judge's magistrate's review. But again, I when we're talking about reasonable probabilities of different outcomes, first of all, the cross-examination of Crystal Graham, this would have only been offered to show her inability to recall details, and yet as post-conviction or as trial counsel astutely summarized, the police tapes, Eckstein's tape, and the transcripts all show that her ability to recall details is pretty darn clear. So what was the need to dwell on her psychological problems? And in any event, there was evidence introduced of her psychological problems to some extent, and so the judge had a pretty good idea of her credibility. And I would also suggest that this court review her testimony. I think even without testimony of her psychological problems, it's pretty clear that this is a very disturbed individual, and I think that was pretty clear to the trial judge as fact finder. Also, and again, with respect to the
best evidence that she was a disturbed individual was the terms on which she agreed to be a hit woman.
Yeah, and the prosecutor argued
Inc. in Chicago would never do business that way
for $10,000. I agree, and the prosecutor
$10,000 after the fact.
After the fact, yes,
$500 before the fact.
Up front, yeah,
The person who has had his wife rubbed out to probably is hard to catch up with and get to pay the $10,000 later.
These are, however,
insisted on being paid up front.
These are, however, $1,998. But be that as it may, the prosecutor, in fact, argued
Murder, Inc. got $10,000 up front in the 30s.
Yeah, that's true. And the prosecutor argued in closing argument that Eckstein, in fact, found someone crazy enough to go along with this plan, that she was a disturbed individual, and pointed that out to the judge.
Smart enough to wise up before it actually happened.
And then she finally came to her senses with the aid of, by the way, I would suggest, of another critical witness of the trial, Dolores Werman, who was Eckstein's girlfriend at the time, who suddenly developed a fear of him because of some bizarre behavior of him towards her that was discussed in her testimony, where she and Crystal Graham discussed what was going on, and she, Werman, encouraged Graham to go to the police. So, we're talking about reasonable probabilities here, and I think to overturn this, you would have to conclude that the state courts were wrong and the district court erred in concluding that there is no reasonable probability of a different outcome here. Had counsel successfully gotten Mr. Eckstein's September 3rd tape suppressed from evidence? There are no further questions. I'll conclude my argument.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Hennick. The case is taken under